This is Armand DeMille auditioning for you. With the positive mind here at WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. We're bringing you some interesting stuff today. Today, we're going to talk about complaining. We want to talk about the nature of complaining, what complaining is, what it is, and how it works, and what's it all about. And we have in the studio with us Linda Bonella, and we have also with us Guy Winch. And, of course, Lauren Sykes, who always helps us out. Guy Winch is author of a book called The Squeaky Wheel, a very effective book, a very interesting book, and I want to talk about that with Guy. Guy, welcome to WBAI.
Thank you very much.
Say that again, will you?
Thank you very much.
Oh, now I can't hear Guy. I can't hear Guy on the air. Hold on a second. Once more, Guy.
Thank you for having me.
Ah, there it is. Hi there. All right. Hey, listen, Guy, your name of the book is called The Squeaky Wheel, and it said that for a very good reason, because I think this is not just about complaining for the sake of making yourself effective and being heard, but you believe that complaining has to do with being almost a social consciousness. You have to learn how to complain, right?
Yes, it's definitely something we have to learn, pay attention to, in some cases unlearn the way we're doing it at the moment and learn the correct way to do it.
All right, well, let's talk about what it's about. Why do we want to learn how to complain?
Well, complaints are our ways of expressing dissatisfaction and trying to create change, whether the change is in our lives, in our relationships, in our communities, in our neighborhoods, in our countries. So complaints are very important, and when they have that function, except we're not often using them to create change, and there's the problem with how we complain at the moment.
So there are two ways of complaining. One way is to complain just to express some angst, and it's not that you're trying to solve a problem. You're just complaining about it. You're bringing the weight on it. And how many of you out there live with somebody who complains all the time? It's almost like they're complaining as if they want something to happen. But what you're saying, Guy, is some people don't want anything to happen. They just want to complain.
Right. I mean, often people complain, and I call that kind of complaining, the one you described, I call it venting. Because really there's this magical thinking that if I just express dissatisfaction to enough people, something might magically happen. But if you ask people, do you think something will, are you formulating your complaint, addressing it in a way that can create change, they'll say, well, probably not.
Well, we've learned enough about the biochemistry of people, and especially through brain imaging, that we've learned that complaining does have a chemical effect, especially on raising serotonin with people, especially with women. So that complaining, if you complain to someone else, it in a way does make you feel better. It may not get anything good. So if you sit in the nail salon and you complain to somebody who doesn't even speak English, that's okay. It somehow does something for you, but it may not solve any problems. It may just perpetuate problems by giving you some kind of juice that makes you feel better. Otherwise, people wouldn't complain. I mean, I wonder very often if I listen on a park bench to two elders, I wonder, what are they doing? You know, if I was down in Florida once, I remember being by a retirement home, and it was at a pool where I heard these people just complaining like crazy to each other. And I said to myself, they can't be doing this for no good reason. Because their complaints either about their bodies, the doctors, the pool, the kids running around, the dogs. They just did it. And what did they get out of it? And they seemed to get something. It was how they formed their club. Now, that's one kind of thing, so I can't put that down. It must work, otherwise people wouldn't do it.
Well, yes, but it's kind of like a sugar high. In other words, it spikes very quickly, and you crash very quickly, so you keep needing to have another piece of candy. You keep needing to voice another complaint. That's why those people just kept going from topic to topic to topic, because the satisfaction with that kind of complaining doesn't last very long.
I used to do workshops in New York, or lectures in New York, and when I would do a workshop, I would have, like, you know, if there were maybe 100 or 200 people in the audience, I had a thing called the complaining exercise. It was an amazing thing. I'd have people walk in the room, and I'd say, could you turn to each partner on either side of you And I want you to complain about everything. Complain about the weather. Complain about the seats. Complain about me. And the audience would build in this complaint, and you'd hear it build, and you'd hear it build. And, and I kept said, keep complaining, keep complaining. And then when they'd get to a crescendo, all the way at the top, I'd say, now stop. Close your eyes. Relax. And you would see this wave of comfort come over all of them, and they would smile at each other, almost as if the complaining did have the juice. So that's one kind. I'm going to validate it. I'm going to say, complainers, I understand. But now let's talk about your responsibility as a complainer. And this, I believe, guys, starts with you, not only as a psychologist, but moving into a new apartment in Manhattan. Could we hear that story?
Yes, that's how I opened the book. A number of years ago, I moved into a new apartment, which I was very excited about because it had wonderful southern unobstructed views, which is rare in Manhattan. Now, it had those views because there was an empty lot outside those windows, the living room and the bedroom windows. And at that time, any empty lot was an endangered species in Manhattan. And indeed, soon enough, the developers moved in, and they started building a luxury building outside my apartment.
Now, did you know that before you moved in, when you saw the empty lot, you said this is short-lived?
I knew it was a matter of time, but it could take years. I didn't know how long it would take. It was months, okay, rather than years. And so they started building this building, and it had an underground garage, unfortunately, which meant they had to bore deeper into the bedrock than usual. And when you're on the same slab of bedrock as the people boring few feet away from you, your whole apartment vibrates.
People don't understand why that is. You know, let's talk about bedrock. This is the Manhattan schist, right?
Manhattan schist. It's the hardest substance there is, practically, in terms of construction.
This is like a big rock that's down there.
It's a slab. And if you're on the same slab and somebody's jackhammering next to you, you will feel the vibrations. Hmm. And these were some jackhammers. So, literally, you would hear the dishes rattling in the kitchen in the morning. The bed would move, your pictures would rearrange themselves on the walls. It was that kind of, and the noise that accompanied that was incredible. So there was no ability to speak on the phone, to certainly think or conduct any conversations. So everyone in my building was very upset about this huge interruption, and it went on for months because of that underground garage. And they all called the management company, it was a rental building, to complain. They called, they wrote letters, they voiced complaints in numerous ways. And the management company said, well, this is not our building, we're not responsible for it. You do live in New York, buildings will be built around you, so they're sorry, there's nothing we can do. And I wrote them a letter, same kind of letter of complaint, but I wrote it in my way. And I asked them to give me a rent abatement because of the different standard of living I was now experiencing in the apartment. And I got a call from the management company the next day saying, we got your letter, here's a rent abatement, for numerous, numerous months that actually went on far beyond when the construction did. And it made me start to think about, everyone in the building is complaining, but ineffectively, and my letter was somehow so much more effective, it actually got a result when the management company really had no obligation to respond in any kind of positive way.
So what did you do that was different?
I formulated my letter in a specific way. In other words, I acknowledged that I have no right to demand anything from the management company, that they had no responsibility. Really, all I was appealing to them was by saying, my standard of living has changed. It really is affecting my life. Even though this is not your fault or your responsibility, it would kind of be the right thing to do, not in that language, but it would be the right thing to do to give me some kind of rent abatement to reflect that. But I guaranteed them that I would be grateful for anything they did because I knew they were not obliged to do anything. So it kind of made it easier for them to comply.
So just going in and complaining as if you're going to carry a bat and say, I'm going to come beat down your office, that they may be prepared for. But if you go in there with some sort of reason saying, I understand I don't deserve anything, this is not part of our contract. Not I don't deserve, but it's not part of our contract, and I'm asking you to be fair. Some part of them responded to that.
Absolutely.
Now, I can imagine if I called Verizon with the same thing, I wouldn't get that same kind of response.
I have called Verizon with the same thing.
Tell me.
And I have gotten the same kind of response. I had Verizon take off $600 of charges that were essentially my fault because I traveled abroad and I used my cell phone for email, and the data charges were $600, a new phone, so I had no idea data was that expensive. This was just for checking emails. So when I got back, I called Verizon, and it did take a couple of hours on the phone. They removed every penny of the charge.
There are people who would be responsive to your complaining if your complaint is properly put in there. Okay, so
correct.
Let's get some of the clues. Is accusatory something that works or doesn't work?
Accusatory never works. I mean,
never.
First of all, never. Absolutely never. It will do the opposite. It will turn the other person off. Because we all get defensive when we hear complaints. Even if we're a customer service representative whose job it is to field complaints, it's not a pleasant human experience. So if someone is coming at us and blaming us, and certainly if I'm sitting in a call center somewhere, it wasn't my fault. I didn't make the phone. I didn't make up the policy. I'm just trying to do my job. So when someone's calling and they're furious at me, I will get defensive no matter what my training is. So my approach is always own your responsibility. In other words, with Verizon, I said, my mistake, but my claim with them was, but if I have a new phone and it's that expensive to use email and it's a world phone and no one at the store is telling me, oh, you should get a data plan because that's going to be expensive for you to use abroad when I'm specifically purchasing a world phone, I felt they were responsible.
My guest is Guy Winch, W-I-N-C-H, the name of the book, The Squeaky Wheel. Guy, so if you're at a call center, now this, by the way, goes to relationships as well, and we're going to talk about complaining in relationships. But if you get forwarded to a control center, which you always do, customer service rep, the customer service rep is trained to make you believe that you're being heard. That's what they're training to do, and that if there is a certain point you could cross, and when you cross that path, that rep is giving you nothing. So you have to deal with the fact that that rep does not really work for the company. They don't really work. I mean, they have some power, but how do you get to their power? How do you get to their strength? What do you need to do? Compliment them?
Well,
you need to acknowledge them as humans?
It's a very important point you just made, because one of the first things I would do is you need to ask, what is the limit of your authority? In other words, if I have a dispute over a certain amount and I'm getting to that first person, above $25, $30, they're not going to be able to do anything just because they're not authorized. So if I have a bigger dispute, I'm might start by saying, look, here's my issue. I want to start by asking, is that within the limits of your authority? Are you the person that can help me, or do I need to go through you to get to the person above you?
Oh, what a relief. I never thought of that question. I always wind up being on hold for the next 20 minutes.
Right.
And then the next person has no idea what we were talking about. And then we do it again and again and again.
Right.
Good, good, good. Okay, so you ask a person the limits of their responsibility. What about their name? What about that fact that that's a person on the other side of the phone, acknowledging them as a person?
I always write down the name. And look, the paradox about complaining, especially when it's the call center, is we are going to call them at the time that we're most frustrated and most annoyed. So we're going to have an edge in our voice because we're pissed off, and that's why we're calling. Therefore, I always say, and I know that the person on the other end of the phone is not responsible. It's not their fault. So I will start by saying, I have to first apologize if I sound annoyed. It's absolutely not at you. I know that you are just trying to do your job. So if I sound in any way agitated, please forgive me. I'm just upset about the situation.
Ooh.
Now, here's what's going on.
Whoa, that's terrific. That's terrific.
And humane.
And humane is right. Complaining to your doctors. You should have seen that group, that look. Complaining to your physicians. Trying to get to them about something that you find may be not effective. And is there a process that you think would go near this?
Absolutely. First of all, it's very difficult to complain to our doctors because we're usually in quite a compromising position when we see them. And when we're wearing some kind of gown with all the structural integrity of toilet paper, it's hard to muster enough dignity and oomph to really sound assertive. But the other problem is that if we have a complaint about, for example, long waiting times in the waiting room or how long it took us to get the appointment or other things, it's usually not the doctor that we should be complaining to, and it certainly is not the receptionist that we see on our way in and out. There is usually some kind of facilities manager, hospital manager, clinic manager, or a physician who's in charge, and they are the ones to whom we should address these kinds of complaints. So we actually need to find out who is in charge there, because if it's something about making appointments or waiting times, or even if we're going to complain about our doctor, we really need to do it to the person who can do something about it. And the doctor is going to be too harried to remember that at the end of the day. The nurse, it's not going to be in her domain. The receptionist is not going to risk her job by telling the doctor that people were upset with them. So we need to find out the person in charge and address our complaint to them.
But there's, in a lot of businesses, like in physicians' offices, you get pointed out as a pain in the butt. And when they see you that way, it's like, oh, she's just a pain in the butt. That's it. That's it. You're kind of done for. So it's how do you file your request complaint without being a pain and without being the kind of person that everybody gets annoyed with? Because, I'll give you an example of that. Most of the people, we have a manager here, Thelma Wingate, who nobody really ever upsets her because she has this kind of compassion for people. And Thelma will say almost every time that no matter how much somebody is asking for something, she has an understanding tone about it. That's her skill, but she's been around people a long time. Most of the young folks who are doing reception work and telephone work, they don't have it. They still have parents that they hate. They still have issues that they have to deal with. And they're kids, but it's very hard to get to them because they would react very quickly. It's very important to understand that it's their reaction that's going to determine so much for you. So how do you get to somebody who is barely invested in their job? You know, do you bring the box of donuts?
You know, I'm not against the box of donuts necessarily. Uh-huh. I wouldn't do it every time. But actually, look, I'm not suggesting we should go on a complaint spree and just voice every dissatisfaction we have. I think we should really be wise in choosing what's really important that we want to change or that we want to comment on. But once we do that, I think it's how we deliver the complaint that makes the difference. Because we can complain only once and be considered a royal pain because of how we do it. And we can complain multiple times and be considered the nicest, most constructive person because we did it in such a way that that was what we communicated. So I think that if we learn to communicate complaints in a way that is kind, respectful, constructive, we won't be considered a pain no matter how often we do it.
Well, then what is a complaint sandwich?
The complaint sandwich is a simple technique that I refer to in the book as a general paradigm for how we should complain in all situations. And it has the sandwich structure. There are two slices of bread, and our complaint, the meat, is sandwiched in between. And those two slices of bread are positive statements that we open and close our dialogue with. So the first one I call the ear opener, and the goal there is to start with something positive so that the person's ears remain open to what's about to come, which is our actual complaint. And any kind of positive statement, if we're calling a store, you know, say I've been a customer of the store for a long time, I really enjoyed it. If it's a restaurant, I've enjoyed many meals here. If it's a doctor's office, I really love my doctor, he really helped me out with such and such. Start with something positive. Then the meat of the sandwich is our actual complaint. And the idea here is lean meat. In other words, keep it really specific. This is something you speak about quite a bit. Keep it really specific. You don't need to take a running start and bring up tons of examples from the past. It's not helpful or necessary.
Well, let's go with that a little bit. Being very specific about your complaint means one issue at a time, one little thing. I have a good friend who gets on the phone and she talks about one thing, then adds another, and then adds another, and adds another, and the person on the other side gets confounded. You know, they don't know what to respond to. So the issue is you must keep the meat lean. You got to keep it, or the tofu lean, whichever your preference
right.
is, so that it could be one issue at a time that a person could deal with. So you're introducing with some compliment. You're giving them some bit of a negative, a complaint, And now, what about the tail end?
Just one more thing about the complaint. It has to have two other elements. First of all, I would not marinate the meat in any kind of anger or sarcasm. Our tones should be absolutely neutral, because I've said this to a lot of people, and then they'll tell me what they said, and the language was okay. The tone was horrific. So the tone has to match the language. It has to be neutral and respectful. And secondly, we do need to include what it is we're looking for. What do we actually want? Because that's very helpful to the other person. When they know, oh, this is what they want, it's just this, and things will be okay. Now, that last slice of bread, I call the digestive, and the idea with that positive statement is it's the spoonful of sugar that helps the medicine go down. It's to help motivate the person. It lets them know that if you can respond positively to me in this way, things will be okay between us, no hard feelings, and we can move on. And that's very motivating to someone to know that.
So, let's say you wanted to complain about a delivery of some food,
mm-hmm.
and you call up and you say, hey, I like your restaurant, I've ordered from you many times before, but today you delivered this food and the food was sour or rotten or something like that, and what I'd like you to do is, what you would include is what you want them to do, take it off my bill, replace my...
Absolutely, I'd like you to redeliver it because it arrived cold, or I'd like to get credit for that order because it was not what I ordered. I'd be specific because that's helpful to the other person.
Of course it is. Now you're a psychologist, and
yes.
You know that people, when they feel loaded, you know, when they feel filled with energy about a complaint, I mean, it's very hard for them to control themselves. You're a very logical man, and you're a professional man. You could do it. But most people can't when they're upset. How do they deal with that? I mean, what do? Keep quiet?
Well, that is a huge problem, because, as I said earlier, we tend to complain when we are frustrated and angry. In my book, I have entire sections about emotional regulation, what techniques we can use to actually manage our emotions in that moment and to bring them under control so we can be effective in making the complaint we wish to make. One of the ways to do that, which is best, is called reappraisal or reframing. It's a way of rethinking the situation in our head, so we literally put a different spin on it, and that takes a lot of the bite out of that situation.
How do you take the spin out? How do you change the spin?
Well, the most generic way that I suggest in the book is, let's see if I can test my effective complaining skills. Let's see how effective I can be if I try to be calm. Let me think through the best strategy with this complaint. And the minute we're allocating attentional resources to our thinking and to trying to solve the puzzle of the complaint, they are by definition taken away from our anger and our visceral response.
But you know, guys, sometimes a person may wake up in the morning and they may feel some kind of depression or hormonal imbalance, or they feel agitated or nervous. And on that day, the noise next door is intolerable because of their mental set, because of the way they're feeling. And then at another day, the following day, it's not a bother at all. Oh, that's just Lou opening his squeaky door. How do you... I think very often if you feel very passionate about something, you've got to give it a test of time before you try to effectively communicate it. Because if not, I've heard many a person say to their husbands, I hate this home. I hate this house. I can't stand it. And they complain about the house. And the husband goes and sells the house.
Right.
And then they come back and they, what did you do? Why did you sell the house? You know, because you complained about it. How do you regulate yourself? How do you know yourself to know whether what you're complaining about is real or just for the sake of agitation?
As you said, I think time is a good function in many kinds of situations. For example, if you have a noisy neighbor or if you don't like your house, and you know that feeling changes, you don't like it today, the neighbor's really annoying today, but yesterday they were less so, or the house seemed less as an annoyance or irritant to you the week before, I would give those things some time. But for example, that's a time in which if one spouse is voicing to the other, I hate this house, I don't know how the other spouse is responding to that, but it should be an invitation to a dialogue. Well, do you, honey, should we sit down and talk about moving? Or are you just feeling annoyed today? Because I want to be able to take it seriously if you think we should have that discussion.
So one of the things you might do if you hear a complaint is to ask what's the plan. To ask for the other part that you were saying that you would throw in every complaint. To throw in the spices. To say, okay, now if you're complaining about this, what are we looking for? What are we looking to achieve here? What would you like to do?
Right.
And what would be the plan? So before we run out of time, Guy, I want to make sure we do this with relationships. Now, you and I both have written about the steps about complaining in a relationship. Do you want to go over yours? I mean, ours are practically identical, so I know what I saw in the book. I said, oh, this man really understands it.
Right. They're very similar. I mean, first of all, we both talk about using only one complaint at a time.
One at a time. Don't bring in a basket full of complaints because you'll never cover any of them.
And in that complaint, use only the most recent incident. In other words, it's not effective to say, oh, this happened 20 times because your point is, I didn't like it regardless. So once is easier for the other person to tolerate.
So if you're talking about it and the person's bringing in, yesterday you said during the afternoon this or that, and you're bringing in more times than just the moment, you know that this may be non-effective, or sometimes it may be complaining just for the sake of complaint.
Right, and it will overwhelm the other person. So
yes.
If your goal is to get a response from them, that's not going to help you there. The other thing is, and you speak about this as well, is not to generalize specific incidents into overall character slams or criticisms, to really keep it simple in that way. You also talk about being clear about what you want, so there's an actual agreement. You call it an agreement, I call it asking for what you want, but you should make sure there is a result and a mutual understanding at the end of that complaint talk, so that you can both be very clear, we discussed this, we agreed upon this. That should be stated, and stated clearly. The other thing, I think, is, again, the tones are very, very important. And the affirmation of the complaint sandwich to begin and to end with this feeling of agreement and conveyance of affection and of love in some ways is really important in relationships, because if you make it easy for the other person to hear you, to comply, to respond to you, you're really doing something marvelous for your relationship, because you're creating this reality that when we have problems, we can work them through. And that strengthens the foundations of any relationship.
Linda and I are working on a program that we'll be presenting to you probably tomorrow about working through the tougher times in relationships, because in relationships, when the times are really tough and there is a complaint to be heard, it's very difficult if you're not really linked or in sync or really friends. It's very hard to go through it, whereas it becomes much easier if you could somehow keep the love present. But here's the problem. If you have a love sandwich, and if I'm on the other side of you, and you come to me and you say, you know, your hair looks very good today, I'm going to go, oops, I wonder what he's going to complain about.
Yes, but if they come and they just start with a complaint, the oops will be bigger.
That's right. So it's somehow you're kind of smoothing it. But it's not just smoothing. It's acknowledging the person. You're saying, I acknowledge you as a being. I see you as a person. You're a valuable being. I'd like to tell you about my part of this. I think finally the one part that you bring up that I would also like to mention is that blame is a very important factor. When you're blaming the other person for your complaint, when you're saying it's your fault that I feel this way, you're almost always going to get a defensive reaction.
Absolutely. I mean, the I statements are very important because it's about how you feel, and you have to give the other person wriggle room if you want them to respond in a way that's productive. If you push them into a corner and paint them into a corner, then they're just going to get defensive and upset. If you give them some wriggle room so they have room to maintain their dignity, to apologize, to take responsibility, they will do so more often than not.
Now, Guy, you also say there's a social responsibility here. It is important. You know, I think about Amazon. Amazon always sends you a letter. How did you like your exchange?
Right.
How did you like what took place? And most people would ignore those.
Right.
You say no, these are very important.
I say we tend to have similar complaints about our neighborhoods, our communities, our municipalities, and our states and countries. And so if we all spoke up about them effectively, we would have such change, and we could really actually make change for the better. I think that complaints can be a huge source of social activism. And even those customer service or customer satisfaction questionnaires, they get a minor response rate, really just 1-2% at best respond to them. But if we all did, then companies would know what we like, what we don't, and they would make changes accordingly. So there's a huge power in complaints to really change our quality of life in every way for the better if we took them more seriously.
So compliment and complaint, both are effective and important.
Both are feedback.
Both are feedback, and a person needs the feedback. What was that saying about a person who has a negative thing to say may not mention it to the person that they feel it about, but they'll mention it to how many other people?
Well, in when it comes to consumer complaints, we'll tell up to 16 people about a dissatisfaction, but only 5% of us will actually tell the company.
And so it becomes really up to us. Now, I wonder when we move that to a government and how we deal with a government and how we deal with a government who's marching into Tripoli all of a sudden.
Well, look at our voter turnout. That answers the question for you. We're all so passionate about what goes on, half of us don't show up.
And half of us don't show up. And you're saying, Guy...
That's in presidential elections. It's much worse, obviously, in non-presidential elections.
Guy Winch... author of The Squeaky Wheel. Guy, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Guy says it is our job to do this. It's our job to make this happen. We're going to take a short break, my friends. When we come back, maybe some of your calls and something else we'll be presenting to you. We're going to take a short break now.
The impoverishment of public discourse on the commercial airwaves is terrifying. We now accept that celebrity gossip is news. We speak in the tired jargon and cliches handed to us by the corporate state, by advertising.
The New York Society for Ethical Culture presents Chris Hedges, war correspondent, Pulitzer Prize winner, and author of Death of the Liberal Class on Tuesday, March 22nd at 7 p.m. Interview conducted by Dr. Joe Chuman. The New York Society for Ethical Culture is located at 2 West 64th Street off Central Park West. For ticket details, visit nysec.org.
No bad news is kind of tough, you know, no bad news. It's very tough. It seems to be tough in this environment. More and more things seem to be happening that I look at and I wonder, how did this all take place? How are we bombing in a new place while there are people struggling for their lives in Japan? And I received a letter from a good friend, Diane Thies, who is a one of our supporters, and she forwarded a letter to me of something that was published in Ode Magazine, published online at Ode Magazine, from Ann Thomas. Ann Thomas is an American who is living in Japan, and she's living in Sendai, right where the earthquake took its greatest toll. And this letter from her, it touched my heart so much that I realized, and I haven't seen it repeated. I haven't seen it on BAI. So I thought it's for us to bring to you. And I've asked my friend Linda Vanella to read it to you in her voice. Here, Linda.
Thank you. Things here in Sendai have been rather surreal. But I am very blessed to have wonderful friends who are helping me a lot. Since my shack is even more worthy of that name, I am now staying at a friend's home. We share supplies like water, food, and a kerosene heater. We sleep lined up in one room. We eat by candlelight. We share stories. It is warm, friendly, and beautiful. During the day, we help each other clean up the mess in our homes. People sit in their cars, looking at news on their navigation screens, or line up to get drinking water when a source is open. If someone has water running in their home, they put out a sign so people can come to fill up their jugs and buckets. It's utterly amazingly that where I am, there has been no looting, no pushing in lines. People leave their front door open, as it is safer when an earthquake strikes. People keep saying, oh, this is how it used to be in the old days when everyone helped one another. Quakes keep coming. Last night, they struck about every 15 minutes. Sirens are constant and helicopters pass overhead often. We got water for a few hours in our homes last night, and now it is for half a day. Electricity came on this afternoon. Gas has not yet come on. But all of this is by area. Some people have these things, others do not. No one has washed for several days. We feel grubby, but there are so much more important concerns than that for us now. I love this peeling away of non-essentials, living fully on the level of instinct, of intuition, of caring, of what is needed for survival, not just of me, but of the entire group. There are strange parallel universes happening. Houses a mess in some places, yet then a house with futons or laundry out drying in the sun. People lining up for water and food, and yet a few people out walking their dogs. All happening at the same time. Other unexpected touches of beauty are first. The silence at night. No cars. No one out on the streets. And the heavens at night are scattered with stars. I usually can see about two, but now the whole sky is filled. The mountains at Sendai are solid, and with the crisp air, we can see them silhouetted against the sky magnificently. And the Japanese themselves are so wonderful. I come back to my shack to check in on it each day. Now to send this email since the electricity is on, and I find food and water left in my entranceway. I have no idea from whom, but it is there. Old men in green hats go from door to door, checking to see if everyone is okay. People talk to complete strangers, asking if they need help. I see no signs of fear. Resignation, yes, but fear or panic, no. They tell us we can expect aftershocks and even other major quakes for another month or two, and we are getting constant tremors, rolls, shaking, rumbling. I am blessed in that I live in a part of Sendai that is a bit elevated, a bit more solid than other parts. So far this area is better off than others. Last night my friend's husband came in from the country bringing food and water. Blessed again. Somehow at this time I realize from direct experience that there is indeed an enormous cosmic evolutionary step that is occurring all over the world right at this moment. And somehow, as I experience the events happening now in Japan, I can feel my heart opening very wide. My brother asked me if I felt so small because of all that is happening. I don't. Rather, I feel as part of something happening that's much larger than myself. This wave of birthing worldwide is hard and yet so magnificent. Thank you again for your care and love of me. With love in return to you all, Anne.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
When you read it, what happens as you read it, Linda?
I guess you can't help but to feel very moved. I feel my heart is very open. I guess that feeling of we're all in this together, it moves me, and I'm sure it moves many of us to be one with those that are experiencing this. And as we speak of complaints and we look at the world in its magnificent awedness, we can't help but to feel the pain that I feel, the pain that that those who are there experiencing that. But it's also a revelation, I think, to me. I feel like a feeling of awe of such an experience. And to be able to feel that from someone like Anne is quite a gift to us all. Thank you. Makes me feel grateful.
212-209-2900 is our number here. We're going to be taking your calls today. Yes, thank you, Diana, as usual. 212-209-2900. So we're talking about two things, of course. We're talking about complaints. And then on the other hand, we're talking about gratitude. Isn't that interesting that they're both on at the same time? Let's see what happens as you call in, and let's see what your response is to this. 212-209-2900. Be sure to tune in tomorrow when we are putting together a program around exactly what you do when you have a solid relationship that gets challenged, you know, by something that you have to deal with, the tougher times. We're going to look at that as well. Let's take one of your calls. This is Armand DeMille, 212-209-2900. Hi, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Armand.
Yes.
Yes, this is Omar calling from
hello,
the Village
Omar.
Of Harlem.
Nice
how
to
are
hear
you,
from
man?
You.
Good hearing you again. You know, when I think about people complaining, I reflect, by the way, that email that you wrote, I would like to try and get a copy of that.
The one that you just got from Anne, I will put that on our Facebook page.
I would appreciate that. That was beautifully, beautifully done. But when I think about complaints that we have here in North America, I think about the times that I spent in Haiti. I think about the times I spent in different African countries where if you had electricity, that was considered a luxury. If you had a telephone, that was an ultra luxury. If you had running water, that was an ultra, ultra, ultra luxury. So I realize how blessed we are. And I have a way of just shutting all of that negative energy out. I don't really like to take it in. You know what I say? There but for fortune go I. I think about the brothers and sisters who are incarcerated right now as we speak. Many of them for things that they have not even done, but they just fessed up to it so they wouldn't have to do life in prison. And I realize how blessed we are just to be able to walk up the stairs and go out on our bikes when we want or go for a walk on the street at 3 o'clock in the morning. Okay? So I really have no complaints.
I hear you, Omar. I want to thank you for that. One of the points that Guy makes, though, is that he says, but there is some corrective process that's necessary, whether it's a complaint or not, that when you see the stuff that's not right, He says we almost have a responsibility to each other to mention it in some way. And for that reason, I feel there is a social consciousness to doing it, whether we call it a complaint or not.
Okay.
But I thank you from the bottom of mine to the bottom of yours.
And remember, Armand, I love you, and there's nothing you can do about it.
Thank you, Omar. Thanks for calling in.
Yes, sir.
212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. This is Armand DeMille.
How are you today, Armand?
I'm good.
This is Ensarah Ra.
Hello, Ensarah Ra.
Doing. First of all, I want to say that I agree probably 137% with the squeaky wheel. You notice the first thing I say to people, when I call to make a suggestion about something that goes on Verizon, the first thing I say to the person on the line, I say, "How are you doing today?" And they go, "How are you doing?" "Oh, I'm fine. Thanks for asking." You know, because I'm asking them how they are, which is something that people like say don't do as much. Another thing is, which is maybe kind of an additional later on, is let's say someone gives me very good service. Are they patient enough? I would say what 100% of the time I say, listen, is there anybody I could talk to, you know, to tell them what you've done, that you've been very professional to me? And they'll say, well, I guess my supervisor. I say, yeah, and I call, because if I'm going to complain about something that's negative, you know, there's a thing I think in 1 Minute Manager where it says, also catch people doing the right thing, you know. And overall, what we're talking about, I guess, in terms of what you're saying and what the letter says, by the way, I taped the letter. I had to keep it on my cassette. Something from the book Lost Horizon, where at the very end, I think the Dalai Lama says, just be kind. Just be kind. Before being correct, I think it said another way, they say before being correct, be kind.
Yeah.
Think of being kind to people. And, you know, it works. It works. It's what I think Wayne Dyer said. He says, when you give that energy to the universe, it gives it back to you. You know, you're trying to be, you say, I want to be positive, or like now I send healing energy to the universe. And guess what? It comes back to me. If I send the other energy, it comes back. It also comes back. And that's simply physics and dynamics and spirituality and law.
Thank you very much, Ensarara. As usual, thank you so much. Thank you for calling.
Thank you, Armand.
Sure. By the way, if you don't want to wait till we put it on Facebook, I don't own this. This was published online. It's by Ann Thomas. It was published on March 14th, and it's in Ode magazine. If you look up Ode magazine, I think you could find the letter yourself. It's remarkable. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. This is Armand DeMille. Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
Hello there.
Hi, Armand. How are you?
Good.
I see we have a lot of the regulars calling up today. That's good.
Some of the old friends, Omar and Ensarah Ra. What about you?
I'm a semi-regular. I'm Austin.
Hey, Austin, how nice to hear from you.
great to hear. Armand, I was thinking that, it is important to look and see like the bus strike in Montgomery to see that technically as a complaint, but also to count that as a complaint of a higher order than something minor. But at the same time, not to completely trivialize complaining about minor things, because sometimes minor things have a cumulative effect, and that as enough people complain about seemingly minor things, there is an aggregate effect of that that can be constructive in changing the ways the company does policies. And I also want to say that, referencing back to Guy, I was wondering, what if everybody in that building had asked for a rent abatement? How would the people have dealt with it? Was that just a token thing that they did? And if, I wonder if Guy approached any of the other people and suggested that, or even let them know that he had been given a rent abatement. Because I'm wondering if they would have said, okay, we'll give it to this one person, but what will we do if the whole building came at us with the same proposition?
Very interesting question, Austin. Very interesting. And almost, it reminds me of Plato's Caves, almost what becomes your responsibility once you realize that you could effectively deal with the agent? Does it become your responsibility to say as well, and what about my others? What about my brothers? What about my sisters? What about the other tenants? And then when that person says, well, we can only deal with you and we can't deal with them, how does that feel? And what's your responsibility at that point? And sometimes I know it's hard to go other than to think just for yourself. But sometimes I have to go beyond it. Sometimes I just can't stand benefiting by myself and not having other people benefit. Sometimes I think it's, I feel bad doing that. You know, I feel bad. Remember phone booths? Do you remember phone booths? Telephones? I used to feel bad if I got money out of the phone booth. I said, there's something wrong with this. I don't want to be a part of it.
Mm.
But thank you, Austin. Thank you, as usual.
Yeah, okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.
212-209. That's Austin, who's a regular contributor to Facebook and The Positive Mind. 212-209-2900. Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the air. Hello there.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi, my name is Lloyd from Freeport. I'm a first-time caller.
Hey, Lloyd, welcome to WBAI. Welcome to The Positive Mind.
Yeah. I used to work in the New York City High School, which is a bastion of complaining and moaning and more complaining, and it became almost the culture and the ethos of the school, so that the teacher's room almost was like a morgue in a way. So one time I decided to ask the people, what do you do outside of this place? What is your real life like? And all of a sudden, the light started to go on in the room. I started getting an entirely different idea of what these people were like. And it was an eye-opener for me. But it didn't last long, because I tended to isolate myself, because I didn't want to listen to the complaining that went on all day long.
So what did you do?
Well, what I did was I decided to isolate myself and tend to my own affairs. You know, I had like a quasi-administrative job, and I had plenty to keep me busy in my office with people I really liked. But in the main faculty room or the small teachers' lounges, that was the prevailing emotional and cultural milieu.
It's a very difficult thing, you know, Lloyd, because when you think about it, and I think about teaching environments because I've been among many of them, and it's almost like a cultural norm for everybody to complain. And teachers in particular, and I hope that I don't get phone calls on this, but teachers in particular seem to have that way of communicating with each other, communicating about the kids, communicating about the administration, complaining about one thing or another. Now, the trouble with this is I understand people get a nice charge out of complaining, but the trouble with it is it becomes an attitude, and the attitude gets passed on to the kids. And so if you have complaining as part of your basic way of functioning, that's going to go everywhere. How do you expect that rubs off on the people that you're teaching?
Well, that's exactly it. You know, I used to have really nice kids, and I didn't want to be tainted by the moaning and complaining that was going on around me. I wanted to enjoy them for who they were. And so I just absented myself from the usual teacher interactions, which would tend to complain not only about the kids and the administration, but about the parents, about the working conditions, and you name it. It was a culture of complaining. And
I was going to say, you know, sometimes I fully agree. I could understand you could remove yourself. Other time, you could try to align yourself in a different kind of way. Like, I remember many settings where I found the same thing happening, and the trouble was that what I would do is go in and bring a vase of flowers, or I would bring a plant, or I would put something down that would say, here is the positive, or I would bring in my positive attitude, not a Panglossian attitude, not one of saying, you know, we can't see the difficulties, but one that showed my positive attitude, but I would have to bring that in there. And I found that, as well as complaining, was contagious.
Yeah.
That once you showed them that there was a positive place to be, that they equally could respond to it.
I had that once. We had hundreds of daffodils in our yard, and I brought in a cut daffodils to some of the secretaries. And when I brought them in for some of the secretaries, the others complained, why didn't they get theirs? So I don't know. You know, it's almost like certain times you really can't win, but I understand what you're saying, that you try to change the culture, but it's almost like banging your head against the wall.
Not necessarily. You keep knocking your head against the wall till somebody answers. You know, Lloyd, thank you very much for calling in, and welcome to WBAI.
Thank you, Armand.
Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're going to have to be going, and we will be back with you tomorrow talking to you about what to do during the tough times. And we'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends.